You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Although today I am not actually at Southwest Baptist University, I am at home, as is David Grubbs, professor of English at Houston Baptist University, also recording from home, although not my home. David, how's it going?
Pretty good. That might actually be fun, you know. I've been sort of fantasizing. Every once in a while, you see that meme circle on Facebook, like which of your Facebook friends are on your zombie apocalypse team, or things like that. And I've been actually thinking, like, who would I want to be crashing during coronavirus with, who isn't here?
Except you're not allowed to do that, right? Like that's the one thing you can't do.
Yeah, I know. That makes it desiderata, right? You know, like, you want it because you can't have it.
Yeah, I suppose. we're what, a weekend at this point? I'm fine. I know there are people freaking out. I'm like, I'm perfectly happy. I can sit at home and read books. Like, doesn't bother me at all. Also joining us today is Jordan Paas. Jordan, you're an assistant professor of history, is that right?
Instructor
of history.
We don't have any grandiose.
Well,
titles.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
an assistant professor for the record.
Yeah. What's that?
I'm an assistant professor for the record. I don't have tenure, so you know.
Well, give it time, right? Give it time. Jordan Paas, instructor of history at Piedmont Technical College in Greenwood, South Carolina, not joining us from home, recording from your office, right?
Yes, because we don't yet have internet at home, which is being kind of makes online learning kind of a booger.
Yeah, at least, no, I certainly feel both for the faculty members. I have colleagues who don't have internet at home by choice, and they're like going to ride this out. They're like, I will not get this. They're digging in their heels. And then of course I have the older colleagues who don't know how to have internet at home. So I feel a little bit bad for both of them.
Well, for us, it was kind of. We moved about a year ago and just didn't really get around to it and
sure.
didn't really mind having the, you know, kind of a sanctum away from all the, you know, all the other stuff, because I try to leave work at work if where I can.
Right.
Coronavirus has put paid to that. But sure. Yeah, we're supposed to get internet sometime this week, so this might be one of the last times I'm in my office for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, we'll see where all of that goes. I could talk about the coronavirus all day, but I probably shouldn't, because that's not our topic for today. A couple of months ago, Jordan reached out to me and said, hey, we should do an episode on C.S. Lewis. And I was like, hey, that's fantastic. Love C.S. Lewis. Happy to do one. And then Jordan replied with, and let's do it on his worst books. And I was like, all right, we can make that happen too. So
it was phrased rather differently. No, it was in response to those the Dune episode that you did with Danny, which was so great. And I had just finally gotten around to reading Dune, coincidentally, so I listened to it and was like, Dune was really good. I'm not much of a sci-fi guy. I read maybe two sci-fi books a year. I think I've actually read a few more than that recently. But I really love Out of the Silent Planet and the other two of the series to a greater or lesser degree. So I thought, hey, there's a lot of stuff we could talk about here, so why not?
Sure. And for the record, I don't hate these books. I just think they're not very good. They're even that's not fair. They're fine. Like they're perfectly serviceable fiction.
You tried The Pilgrim's Regress though?
Yes, it is terrible. Even Lewis thought that was terrible.
Yeah, it's that's one of those books where I would just say it's interesting. With that ellipses before the word interesting, you know, where you're trying to find the right word for it.
It's Southern interesting, right?
Yeah. Maybe live in interesting times.
before we get into the details, this isn't on our outline, but I should ask, how did you guys first encounter C.S. Lewis, and then how did you first encounter these specific books? And I guess today we're just talking about Out of the Silent Planet, but we can include the trilogy overall. David, do you wanna go first on that?
Sure. First encountered Lewis through my dad, who read the Narnia books to us. Fortunately, that was before publishers started boxing them up in chronological order instead of publication order,
right.
Which meant that I encountered Narnia in the order that Lewis wrote it and meant it to be encountered. And then after that, I think he checked out the Space Trilogy from the library, the church library, because I remember seeing him read it. I remember the cover art. But he never read it to us. I think that originally he might have had that intention, but wanted to look at it himself first. But ultimately decided that it was not something that he wanted to read to us. But he read all of them. And I saw him read them. Sure. And so when I was sort of older elementary, getting into middle school, much of what I read was stuff I'd seen my dad read. That's why I read The Lord of the Rings. It's why and it's ultimately why I read the first two books of the Space Trilogy. I loved Out of the Silent Planet. I got about halfway through Perelandra, and I just never picked up That Hideous Strength, though I love the title. Since then, I've gotten further in the other two. Still have not read all of them in one sitting, but have come at different parts of them for other reasons, because they were adjunct to something that I was looking at. But this particular book, the first one, is one that I've actually read several times and enjoyed a great deal.
Jordan, how about you?
I'm trying to think. C.S. Lewis was just one of those kind of continuous, mental presences, growing up in church. Like, I kind of just always kind of sort of had heard of him, so I can't really remember a beginning to that. And our church had a bookstore, and there were always C.S. Lewis books in there. I don't think they moved for a really long time, but eventually in high school, somehow I kind of picked up that, he was a great writer and also a great thinker, and to a slightly nerdy kid, that, I needed a little bit more intellectual content to kind of what I was also picking up from church, or at least I had that appetite even when I couldn't have put words to it. So I actually bought out the stock of C.S. Lewis stuff in our church bookstore. And the first one I tried to read was The Great Divorce, because it sounded intriguing. And something about it, when I was in, I think I tried it as like a junior in high school. I remember reading it at like midnight, and something about the initial setup with the Gray City like disturbed me so much, I put it away for a couple of years. Then I read it in like one go as a freshman in college, and so I really dug into him beginning in college, and which was for biographical reasons we don't have time to get into, really was kind of a godsend for me, and blitzed through a bunch of his books and have ever since. I picked up in the very cheap mass market paperbacks the first Out of the Silent Planet, the first of the Space Trilogy or the Ransom Trilogy, in the college bookstore, and I still remember sending an email to a friend from high school telling him, we were exchanging what we were reading. I said, "Oh yeah, I got Out of the Silent Planet," and I just still remember his response. He must have been a kindred spirit to Coyle. He's like, "It's a real shame you bought any of Lewis's fiction." maybe that discouraged me, but I gave it a shot, and I must have gotten through the first couple of chapters, because the last thing I remember reading of it is flying through space and it getting hot. But at some point I bailed. I came back to it the summer after I graduated from college, when I just had kind of a what they would now call a gap year. And I think I read through all three in like a week or something. And they just kind of hit me at exactly the right time. Probably my favorite is actually Paralandra, but it's been since then, since I've read it. So I'm looking forward to rereading it. But Out of the Silent Planet kind of grabbed me in just the right way. And it's not my favorite Lewis book. I've read dozens of others in the meantime. But I really enjoy it. So
yeah, I'm kind of like many people, I was exposed to the Chronicles of Narnia first, and in a box set, but in a box set that was boxed in publication order. So it must have been one of the early ones. We happened to have it. I would guess that I got it for Christmas at some point, although I don't remember when. And then because it was books that we had, they ended up getting reread when I was growing up. So I would spend summers in middle school driving a truck in the fields with a lot of downtime, waiting on the truck to be loaded, and then would have books with me. And these, I think, were in the rotation. So I read Chronicles of Narnia. I'm reasonably sure I read that every summer when I was growing up. Again, not because I think it's particularly great fiction, just because it's what we happen to have. And then when I went to college, I don't remember who this was, but someone said, "Well, have you read?" They were talking about Chronicles of Narnia, and I was like, "Yeah, I've read that. It's fine." And they had said, "Well, have you read Mere Christianity?" Which I hadn't. So the school library, the University of Wyoming library, had it. So I checked it out and thought it was fantastic. So I, over the next 4 years, read everything by Lewis they had in the library. I don't remember where in that read through the science fiction trilogy fell, but I know it was in there, and I remember reading it and thinking this is not nearly as good as his nonfiction stuff, and I stand by that today. It's fair. Fine. I tend to think that Lewis is a phenomenal nonfiction writer. His fiction, it's adequate. And Tolkien is sort of the opposite of that. I think Tolkien's fiction is fantastic. His nonfiction is, you know, it's fine. I would never recommend anyone pick up and read, the one about Beowulf, the monsters and the critics, right? I wouldn't hand that to a non-academic, non-English major friend and say, yeah, you should read this.
That's fair, but who would do that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but again, that's what I'm saying. I would do that with Lord of the Rings, and Lewis is sort of the opposite. I would give someone even Lewis's academic nonfiction, I think, is still fairly readable. Like it's well written enough that you could give someone the Allegory of Love and say, hey, yeah, you might enjoy this, and they might, right? Again, I think their skill sets are different in the different fields.
Maybe not O Hell.
You know, I know I read that when I was an undergrad because the university had it. I couldn't tell you anything about it.
That's why.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's a book that he was compelled to write. So.
Right. Well, right. So in the same way with Tolkien, I wouldn't give, you know, the Silmarillion to someone to read because it's fiction and it's his, but it's not sit down and read through it kind of fiction. We should dig into Out of the Silent Planet. I didn't write this down. Who was going to talk about the publication history here?
That was me.
Okay, sorry. Go for it, Jordan.
No, it's good. Yeah, it's funny you put it that way about. I don't know. I feel like Lewis excels both at fiction and nonfiction. I think more on the nonfiction side, honestly. And I mean, I go back to his essays and his other books over and over and over again. I feel like with fiction, though, he took a while to kind of find his feet, and we were joking right before the show about The Pilgrim's Regress, which is a book almost nobody reads anymore. And if you've tried to read it, you'll probably understand why. I can only imagine Tolkien's reaction to that very clumsy allegory. But Tolkien did love Out of the Silent Planet. I went through his letters to find references to it, and he was quite the cheerleader for it. Nevertheless, I do feel like with this book and the next, Lewis is again sort of finding his feet as a writer of fiction. So when you look at something like Narnia, which is from about starts about a decade later, or even something like The Great Divorce, which is so stripped down and simple, this actually reminds me a lot more of like a Chesterton novel, where it's,
yes,
There's a tone to Chesterton's fiction where it's not quite real feeling. You know, everything feels heightened in a very particular way. The characters are very clearly like the incarnations of the ideas that animate them. Where, you know, in a Chesterton book, you know, human, you know, two human beings never really sit down and have a chat. You know, it's always kind of like these ideas and concepts and worldviews kind of like bouncing off each other like billiard balls. Lewis is, I think, a more skilled fiction writer than Chesterton was, as much as I love Chesterton. But I got that kind of tone, a little bit of that from this book, having read a lot of Chesterton in the interim, particularly, again, you know, maybe stuff like Man Alive or some of Chesterton's other, you know, like the Napoleon of Notting Hill or something like that. And that makes sense because I know that Chesterton was a influence on Lewis's conversion. And I know, you know, even before he converted, he thought of Chesterton as kind of like this really sensible fellow, except for the whole religion thing. So he read widely in Chesterton, which is, I think, something he shared with Tolkien. So that influence, I think, is there. And Chesterton had only been dead for 2 years by the time this book was published. So I think that might be lingering in the background. But the story is characteristically Lewis, but again, kind of shaking off kind of awkward early stages. So published in 1938, we can all talk about some of the inspirations and influences here. I know David has some stuff to say about H.G. Wells, who Lewis explicitly name drops a couple of times and even kind of backhandedly apologizes to in a prefatory note. Lewis and Tolkien, though, even though they've got this, you know, tweedy academic side to them that you especially see in some circles, they loved them some adventure fiction. So I know that Lewis, and once I ran across this in my reading for this episode, I remembered how many times I've seen Lewis refer to the novel A Voyage to Arcturus, which is apparently a fairly clumsy sci-fi novel written in 1920 about, you know, it's kind of sci-fi. It's also kind of mystical, involving this, like, you know, transport across the solar system on this journey that's got, you know, kind of like mystical and supernatural overtones. I wondered about maybe an Edgar Rice Burroughs influence, because Burroughs had that entire series set on what he called Barsoom, right, Mars. Very, very dramatically different in character, but I think maybe some of Burroughs's vision of these kind of, you know, burly, naked Conan the Barbarian types populating Mars might be at least a little bit of what Lewis is reacting to here. And the story that I've run across several places and never really seen disputed was that Tolkien and Lewis were kind of commiserating over the relatively low state of popular fiction and genre fiction at the time, which the more things change, right? and so they apparently set each other a challenge to, you know, write genre stories. And Lewis decided to undertake a sci-fi novel. Tolkien was going to write some kind of time travel adventure, and Tolkien being Tolkien, he never finished that. But Lewis apparently cranked out of The Silent Planet and apparently shopped it around the Inklings a little bit. Tolkien refers to revisions made to it in some of his letters and ways that Lewis apparently dramatically improved it from the manuscript version. And brought it out in 1938, and I think the timing, I mentioned Chesterton's death earlier, that's 2 years in the past. A year in the future, of course, is the outbreak of World War II, which I think Lewis, I'm not going to say he's prophetically predicting something like that. It was pretty obvious to anybody with eyeballs what might be on the horizon in 1938, because that's, you know, the Anschluss has been recent, and, you know, this is the year of the Munich Conference and things like that. But Lewis is very, very concerned throughout the 1940s, especially, not just with the actual physical threat of ideas like Nazism, but with the ideas themselves. And I think as we can, you know, talk about this a little bit, I think some of those cold, cruel, scientistic ideas that he sees as a imminent threat in 1930s Europe are some of what he's trying to dramatize here with, again, positive counterexamples. What would y'all add to that?
I agree regarding Edgar Rice Burroughs. there aren't a lot of kind of naked Conan the Barbarian sword fights going on in Out of the Silent Planet. But you do have the first beings that the Earthman encounters are very physically different from him, and yet there are scenes involving the learning of language.
Yeah.
The acquisition of language is very important in Princess of Mars. Now, Edgar Rice Burroughs is not nearly... He doesn't have the background in philology and all the rest of that, but there are gestures in that direction. He's very interested in language acquisition. Shows up in Tarzan, too.
Yeah. Did you want to mention Wells here?
Yeah, but just one more thing from Barsoom is the springiness of the mossy turf. The way the ground on Barsoom is described matches very much some similar descriptions of the turf, the terrain in the Barsoom books. But for Wells, I mean, a lot of it is much more in terms of character. The character types among the humans, the creatures of Malacandra are nothing like the sort of squiddy aliens from War of the Worlds or the more insectile aliens of First Men in the Moon. But the human characters are much more like the human characters of those novels in the ways that they react and respond to the alien. So I think once we start talking more, maybe in more depth about who our characters are in this novel and what their ambitions are, what their traits are, I think those parallels will show up more. The other thing is that the ship that they fly from Earth to Malacandra or Mars in is round and doesn't have any real explanation for how it works. That's somewhat like the round ship that's flown to the moon in First Men in the Moon. There is a little more ridiculous pseudoscience in Wells' novel, but that novel is much more tongue-in-cheek than War of the Worlds is. It's patently ridiculous in the way that it's put together.
There's some of that in Burroughs too, right? The airplanes that run on like the fifth ray or sixth ray or whatever it is.
Yeah. Very, very clearly, Burroughs is writing just at kind of like the front edge of public awareness of things like radiation.
Right.
People know that it's there, but they don't know what it can do, and so it just sort of becomes, you know, the science that you just sort of throw out there to explain whatever's happening. You know, like, well, it's like superhero comic books.
Yeah.
it was radiation, and then it was mutations, and now it's, well, whatever, I don't know what it is now.
What TV Tropes calls applied phlebotinum.
Yeah.
Something like that. The ship is made of unobtainium.
Yes, the ship is made of unobtainium.
Yeah, I love the way Lewis kind of hand waves all of that, where you, and it helps that he's got a snotty intellectual character to do it. You know, it's like, some of the less observed properties of solar radiation, you're too dumb to understand it. And moving on. Which I think has actually helped it age maybe a little bit better. Because I know the parts of sci-fi that I get impatient with are the ones that take a long time explaining stuff that we now know is completely erroneous.
Yes. Yeah.
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 Well, we should probably talk about the novel itself, the plot bits anyway. I'm assuming most of our listeners are going to be familiar with the book, but just as a refresher, the main character, Ransom, who is, you know, pretty clearly, I think Lewis tells us at one point in some of his other writings, this is Tolkien, right? This is which, you know, may explain why Tolkien liked the book so much. but Tolkien is going for a walk one day, you know, quite happily out by himself, and ends up getting kidnapped by Weston and Divine, for various reasons that are not exactly his fault, but he's not completely innocent either, and taken to Mars because Weston and Divine, Weston being this famous physicist and Divine being a childhood acquaintance of Ransom's, they take him to Mars thinking that the natives there want some kind of human sacrifice, when in reality the natives just wanted someone to talk to who wasn't Weston or Divine, and lands on Mars, escapes from Weston and Divine, thinking that he's going to be sacrificed, and begins to falls in with a different group of natives and learns the language while he's living among them. Where it is helpful to be he is a philologist, right? I forget if they exactly say that's what he is. That would not have worked if it had been me in that circumstance. Languages are not my strong suit, up to and including English. So he learns the language and then is sent to. By these beings that he's living with, and I'm going to leave the pronunciation of all of these names to you guys. Sent by this particular alien species to the head entity of the planet. They don't really tell him much about this entity other than that this creature is in charge. Along the way, he runs into these other alien species that live on Mars. At this head of the planet, he is reunited with Weston and Divine, who have been captured because they've been killing these alien species. And then judgment is passed on all of them for being awful, and they're sent back to Earth on the spaceship. Which when they return to Earth, it dissolves. The spaceship dissolves, so they're not able to return to Mars again. That's sort of the big picture view. Of course, there's a lot more going on than that. That's just the rough outline of the narrative. David, can you tell us a little bit about these? Well, first, did I miss any big plot points in along the way?
No.
Yeah,
it's a simple narrative.
Yeah, it's a conversation and then a trip to have another conversation with conversations along the way.
And Ransom socially distances himself and it saves his life.
Yeah. Aggressively socially distances himself. David, can you talk to us about some of these characters that I just blew by, especially Ransom, Divine, and Weston, but maybe also... the chief spirit, Maladil, would probably also be one worth mentioning.
Yeah. So Ransom is Ellen Ransom is our protagonist. He is like very first page, at least in the version that I read. Very first page, he is declared to be a fellow of Cambridge and a philologist. So that's we don't know what he looks like, but we know. Like, he's a tweety guy who knows what, like, Proto-Germanic is. So, that's interesting. In terms of the plot, he is... One of the first things we learn about him is that he enjoys walking, he enjoys being alone, but he also is a kind and genial soul who will stick his neck out if he thinks that someone else is being mistreated. So, in TV tropes terms, you designate the villain by having them kick a puppy in the first scene. You make someone sympathetic by having them pet a kitten in the first scene. Our opening scene for Ransom establishes him as a pretty good guy. In terms of the kind of character that he is, because he's not of a scientific bent, it really does help to obscure the fact that Lewis is not at all interested in telling us how they get to Mars in terms of physics or technology. All of that can just be hand-waved because our protagonist wouldn't understand it. But the parts that Lewis is interested in, the encounters with a sort of non-human intelligence, the shape of an alien language, even an unfallen or a Damic language, those are things that Lewis is very interested in. And so his protagonist is one who is fitted to explore the world in the way that Lewis is interested in developing it. I mentioned earlier the ways that these characters are in some ways similar to Wells' protagonist. He reminds me a lot of the protagonist of War of the Worlds, who is a more thoughtful writer kind of character. He fancies himself a philosopher, and much of that sort of alien invasion novel is spent in the protagonist sort of herring off into sort of more intellectual or philosophical or meditations that are not very immediate in terms of their concerns. Ransom is a bit like that. He's interested in the implications of what he's seeing. He's not just interested in what can I eat that is safe to eat. Right? He's not. It's not the Martian movie where he's just obsessed with like growing potatoes in his own poop. he's fascinated by the implications of all of this experience on the larger world of ideas that he's engaged with. The other two human characters, Weston the scientist and Divine, his acquaintance from childhood, map on very closely to the two protagonists of First Men in the Moon, a guy named Bedford and a scientist named Cavour. And Divine is an opportunist. He's smooth. He's good with words. He can make himself very socially acceptable. And yet he seems to have no conscience to speak of. he's very pragmatic in terms of self-preservation, but he will get up to some serious wickedness if he thinks that it will profit him. And that's his main concern, is profit. And he's very much like Bedford, who is the narrator of Wells' First Men in the Moon, whose first thought when he meets this scientist who has the technology to go to the moon is, what are the industrial applications of this technology? How can we patent this as quickly as possible and make a pool of money to swim in like Scrooge McDuck, right? Like that's his first instinct. Weston is a scientist but also a kind of idealist, with the ideal that he's committed to being the continued survival of humanity. He's one of those sort of movie scientists who seems to dabble in all of the different sciences and has thoughts about all of them. He can be competent in whichever branch of science he needs to be at any given time. So even though he's a physicist making spaceships, he's also very interested in things like human evolution and the life cycle of planets and things like that. But he wants humans to keep surviving. And so his technology for him has a very strong idealistic edge. And that makes him very much like Cavour, the scientist in First Man on the Moon, though his ideals are much more about, we will learn, we will expand human knowledge, and that's why we're doing it, not for money. He's not interested in profit. He's just interested in expanding the sum of scientific knowledge. But in both novels, Wells' novel and Lewis's novel, you've got the profiteer and the scientific idealist who get in over their heads, driven by whatever motives they have. They find themselves on a world that overwhelms them with its strangeness, and the first trip that the first trip that Weston and Divine take to Mars that we only hear them refer to in very brief snippets, is probably a lot like Wells' novel First Men in the Moon, which ends in a kind of ignominious retreat. Though in that novel, the scientist is accidentally abandoned. So the three main characters are each interested in the world they're exploring in a different way. They each reach, they each represent different kinds of ideals, different kinds of interests. They each have different motives for their journey. And as a result, the world that they land on treats them, I think, in different ways. Only Ransom is really able to ever understand it, the planet that they're on. But that's because he comes into it with a bent that is towards understanding the other and sympathizing with the other, which is, frankly, it's one of the first things we learn. He's a scholar of language, and he's sympathetic.
Hmm. Right, and not sympathetic in the way that Weston thinks he is sympathetic, where his sympathy is for the human race, right? But he is sympathetic for specific individuals.
Yes.
Right? The mother who's lost her son, who's maybe not all that bright, and the aliens who get killed, and so on.
Oh, yeah. Weston would just throw, you know, stacks of people into a wood chipper for the sake of kindness to humanity in the abstract.
Right.
Right.
But Ransom will, you know, put himself in personal peril for an individual stranger. Different.
Well, any other characters that we should mention? Like I said, I think the only other character that really stands out is... I don't know how to say this. Maybe we should do terms for do key terms first. Maladil, is that how you pronounce it?
Or Maladil? I'm not sure where the emphasis is supposed to be. I kept putting it on the first syllable, but I don't know.
Sure.
Well,
this
Maladil is yeah, I guess that's a good transition point. Some of this other thematic stuff, one of my favorite Lewis essays comes from a couple years after this, and it's The Necessity of Chivalry. And yeah. I think he explores some very similar, and that's written during the Blitz, right? And Weston would absolutely be, you know, manufacturing bombs for the Luftwaffe in the interest of, you know, in that case, maybe saving not the human species, but, you know, the German race or whatever. I think it's telling that from the beginning, the thing that gets Ransom involved in this mess is an act of chivalry. But yeah, so some of the linguistic stuff. One of the really important terms when Ransom begins to connect, and again connecting not through abstract scientific principle or through just, you know, this kind of rapacious materialism, through language, which requires community, is Hnau, H-N-A-U. And Hnau is both a noun and an adjective. You can be a Hnau, or your kind can be Hnau. It's more or less sentient, probably rational is the best, you know, or something that is ensouled in a very real way, because he meets
soul.
Yeah, right. Because there are other species on Malachandra, which is the Martian name for Mars, or in the heavenly language, really. There are other species of what we would call animals, but the sentient, rational beings that he meets are of three kinds, and their Hnau-ness is a very important recurring theme through the book. The fact that even though they are different, they are all endowed with this rationality, this reason, which is, you know, on Earth seen as what separates human beings from other creatures, but actually is actually shared across several species here. And where this is especially, you know, when Weston returns into the story at the end, you know, he makes a big deal out of the immense value he places upon reason, when in fact he is acting against reason and actually committing crimes against Hnau creatures the entire time. So the three species, the first that Ransom meets are the Hross, or the plural Hrossa. It's kind of he does leave the descriptions vague enough that you can kind of fill in some gaps. It's kind of like a 7 foot tall otter that's really skinny. Lives on land, but spends a lot of time on the water in like coracles or kind of primitive boats. They fish. They are singers and storytellers and dancers. This establishes a theme throughout of Ransom, who is again sympathetic. Both we sympathize with him, but he sympathizes with the other characters and is, you know, approaches them with an attitude of openness rather than, you know, Weston and Divine, who immediately reach conclusions. Like this feels like a very late 19th century set of attitudes that they have toward quote unquote primitives. Even Ransom has a lot of those basic assumptions and attitudes about these people, because he sees people that live in like handmade boats and mostly get by on fishing and live in like straw huts and have no written literature, and he makes assumptions about them. And maybe one of my favorite scenes in the book is when an elderly Hross tries to ask Ransom where he came from, and Ransom thinks he has to kind of like dumb it down, like you see in old movies of people talking to tribesmen. He tries to explain that he came from, through the sky. And there's this great moment where Ransom has to stop the Hross from explaining that there's no air up there. Like, okay, these people are as intellectually as capable as I am, so we're actually more equal than he would have been led to assume, right? By this kind of, you know, post-Victorian scientific prejudice.
Right, you know, up until that point, he was shouting at them, right? Oh, yeah. Trying to make them understand.
Gesturing. Like, the Eiffel Tower, you know. He'd make a really great American tourist. The second species, that's the first species he actually meets. The reason he, socially distances himself from Divine and Weston, it becomes clear their intentions for him are nefarious during their, you know, if it wasn't clear when they kidnapped him. Becomes clear in the flight to the to Mars that they're going to hand him over to people they call the Sorns, which they're the proper Malachandrian plural is Soroni. These are even taller, grayish, feathery humanoid creatures that are. It's almost like he's describing the uncanny valley, where they're just human enough to give him the creeps and have like kind of long, lugubrious faces. They start walking across the water to reach them, and so that's what compels Ransom to flee, and that's when he falls in the Hrossa. As it turns out, though, the Sorns are kind of the lonely intellectuals of Mars or Malachandra. And again, one of Ransom's assumptions is challenged when he, you know, being an Oxford scholar himself, he's like, oh, this is the intelligentsia. They're obviously in charge because they're the smart ones. As it turns out, that's not actually the case, right? There is, if anything, no rivalry between these two very different kinds of beings. And the Hrossa are very content to refer any complicated question to the Soroni, right? They just repeatedly say, that's the kind of thing the Soroni know, right? The final class, and the ones that Ransom hears a lot about and only meets at the end, are the Piffletriggi, which are the nearest I'll try to wrap this up. The nearest corollary I could think of are Tolkien's dwarves. They're kind of underground artificers. They are kind of the artistic and I don't want to use the word industrial. They make stuff, right? They've got smiths. They practice sculpture, things like that. There's some pretty delightful scenes involving them trying to kind of soften the ugliness of the human species for artistic representation, which I thought were very entertaining. Throughout, all three of them constantly refer, because Ransom, being a good European of the early 20th century, is constantly trying to find out who's in charge and how they collect taxes and run their state. They constantly say, oh, well, Oyarsa is in charge. Oyarsa rules all of us. You know, we don't rule each other. That would be weird. Why would anybody do that? And Oyarsa is the Eldil of the planet Malachandra. And what gradually emerges, and it's Lewis has said in letters that he was pleased that a lot of people read this novel, seeing it only as sci-fi and not detecting the theology he had woven into it. I honestly don't know how that's possible, because it was just so on the face of it to me. But that's my own perspective and background coming out probably. Oyarsa, the Eldil of Malachandra, is the, what the New Testament would call, you know, principalities and powers. You know, he's an angelic power that has authority over this particular sphere of the solar system. Ransom meets him at the end, and they have some discussion. They bring Divine and Weston. They've managed to capture Divine and Weston, and there's kind of a a trial before Ayarsa, and Ayarsa, of course, is only a local power. The ultimate power is Mal-Eldil, who it gradually emerges as kind of the Malachandrian name for God. But by the time all of this is becoming apparent, Ayarsa is expelling them from Mars, never to return. That's a lot of vocabulary. Anything that I left out, or you think we should cover in a little more detail? That's probably the. There's a lot of other vocabulary like Hondromit and stuff like this, but that's kind of incidental to the plot.
No, I think that probably. I mean, obviously the big term there is the Hanau, right? The sentient being,
yep.
Which I don't remember if they had this discussion or not. Does that include the Eldil? Does that include the angelic beings? I feel like he asks at some point and gets kind of a non-answer, but I don't remember.
It's kind of I can't remember the specific discussion, but it's kind of the image of God sort of thing, as far as I can say. It's like, you know, the gift that Mal-Eldil imprinted on particular kinds of creatures.
Right, and I mean, I suppose we have the same question here on Earth. You know, does that include angelic beings? Right, if it's just rational, if all it is you know the ability to reason, well then I think it would. But if there is something more to it than that, then you know what is the relationship between human beings and angels in terms of our created nature? Mm-hmm. And I don't have an answer to that, but I don't remember how much they grapple with that in the book either.
I don't think they do much. I think Lewis is informed by a kind of medieval view of angelic beings as pure rationality, you know, where they're completely unimpeded by the things that slow down our brains. So, I mean, Ayarsa can be physically present in places, but not as the kind of thing that we are. But what we share is that nowness. I think now is, like you said, probably the most important term for the book, because I think a lot of what Lewis is concerned with is the use and abuse of reason and other reasoning creatures.
Right. Yeah. Well, we've spent a lot of time going over the book and not a lot of time digging into the weeds of it, and we're coming up on an hour. We're not afraid of long episodes on The City of Man, but we should try to exercise some restraint. In terms of topics and themes, we've hit a bunch of those. Any specific thing you guys want to jump on? Otherwise, I'll throw one out. I think one of the interesting scenes is when Ransom is trying to explain why Weston and Divine are trying to kill whoever it is that they're trying to kill, why they've shot one of the Rasa, and this idea that someone would do something evil doesn't seem to have a parallel. And I see someone has written on the outline here the concept of bentness. What is bentness, and what does that have to do with what's going on Melisandre?
Yeah, I put that in the outline. I mean, bentness. I remember that was one of the things that struck me most when I first read it ages and ages ago, because I thought that was a fairly nice expression, approximating kind of sinfulness or fallenness, but in a new and kind of unique way. It reminded me, I mean, again, and this is something I think Lewis would have shared with Tolkien, the view that Satan can't actually create anything. He can only twist things, and of course pervert literally means to twist. So I think that's something that he's kind of driving at. So the introduction of sin necessarily bends or doesn't break. They're pretty clear about that later in the book. But they sin bends things and warps things out of the correct ordering. And it's not clear to me if Melisandre is fallen or not, but it is certainly properly ordered. Right, it is ordered as if it is an unfallen place, which is why you have cooperation between these very different species of people. I don't know, David, what would you add to that?
I don't think they're fallen. They have this concept of bentness, but the examples, especially towards the beginning, when he's with the Hross, the sort of Chewbacca otters. When they give examples of their experience of bent hnau, they are examples of insanity.
Yeah.
of, you know, like a now child that will only eat things that are not food, I think, is one of the examples given.
Dirt, yeah.
So for them, bentness is the term that they use. That's the category that they assign to explain why it is that Weston and Divine behave the way that they do, and even eventually why it is that Ransom does some things. You know, he'll say, you know, at this time I did this thing, and it is because of my bentness. All right, I ran away because of my bentness. Mm-hmm. But they're for the now species of Malachandra, bentness is insanity. It's something wrong with the mind that leads to an irrational behavior. And so that leads me to think that they are not fallen. They don't feel the pull of the kind of actions that that they see in humans that are ascribed to bentness.
They tell a story about when Earth fell. I think the assumption is it's the devil, right? The spirit in charge of the Earth, mm-hmm. Launches some kind of attack on Malachandra that destroys the surface of the planet. So they have to live in these valleys that get dug at the time. And I guess my impression is that Malachandra is a planet that is blighted but not fallen.
Yeah.
Right, so it has been attacked, but it is not itself, like it hasn't given in to, it was a physical external attack rather than that internal spiritual temptation, which whether or not they ever went through that kind of temptation also, we're not told. We get that in Paralandra. And I think we see one of the difficulties that will come up again in Paralandra that a fallen creature has in trying to write an unfallen world. Why on earth would there be insanity in an unfallen world?
Or death. Right? That's what was throwing me, but I think your explanation of, you know, an external attack that blighted the planet and introduced some features we associate with fallenness artificially, I think that makes sense, at least, you know, I don't know about the theology of it, but at least makes sense in narrative terms for the world that he's created here.
Yeah.
And as with many Lewis works, you don't want to push too hard at the theology of it. Like, and that is not his strong suit. Right.
I mean, also, Lewis was, from the beginning of his conversion, he was very comfortable and interested in finding ways to synthesize his Christian faith with the cosmologies of... with the scientific cosmologies that he was familiar with and learned,
right.
And so he has in this book, which is fascinating, like 1938, but he has in this book hints of creation through evolution, right?
Right.
And the idea of a creation in which death was part of the plan, but death did not mean for them what death means for us.
Right.
That was one of the things that I remember as a young evangelical the first time I read the book, because I was very much brought up in a, you know, kind of 6-day special creation, you know, that was very much the context in which I was raised. The first time I read this book, I was like, duh, should I be reading this? Like, bad thoughts, no. But, you know, I just think it's interesting to see Lewis attempt that project of synthesis, you know, and I'm not saying anything about what such projects entail and how they ought to turn out, but I find it interesting that he's approaching that synthesis from the angle of from the angle of storytelling and myth. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That I find very, very interesting.
Mm. Well, and clearly contrasted with Weston, who also believes in a kind of evolution, and believes in progress through evolution, and it is a rigorously and mercilessly applied survival of the fittest.
Yes.
Wherein the fittest is the human race, not necessarily specific human beings, but the human race overall. And to the point where he says, you know, in the first few pages of speech that he has, basically, if a million people have to die in the process, so be it, right? That's it's unfortunate that we have to violate their rights, but, you know, sometimes these things have to happen in order that the great scientific advances can be made and that we can get out into the solar system and spread across the universe. I'm trying to remember the name of there's another Wells book, and I think it's called Things to Come or The Shape of Things to Come, something like that.
It sounds right.
Gets turned into a movie where they explicitly say that, like, this is either humanity is going to, you know, conquer the universe, or we're just going to be utterly wiped out, and by God, we're not going to be wiped out. So Lewis is again going back to the, I'm sure he knew about not the movie but the book.
Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of real-world examples of that in the 1930s. I mean, with, you know,
sure.
collectivization in the Soviet Union, you know, where you starve somewhere between 3 and 5 million Ukrainians to death. But, you know, that's okay, because we gotta remake this from the ground up. And, you know, there's plenty of other examples. I mean, Weston is like all the prejudices of everybody from Herbert Spencer to Hitler rolled into one. And
right.
Again, that you know, everybody on the internet loves Nikola Tesla. But he, you know, he gave a speech on public radio about this time period in favor of eugenics, and makes a lot of similar Weston-like arguments about how pity, which was introduced artificially as a kind of piece of cultural baggage that's not really, you know, that has actually slowed down the ruthless workings of evolution, and ruthless here being a term of praise, right? Pity, right. Preserving, you know, backward or flawed, you know, examples of different species, where really the species as a whole would benefit by, you know, kind of shucking these kind of like dregs or mistakes or you know, like those stores you go to at outlet malls where you can buy slightly warped items or whatever. Get rid of all of that stuff in the interest of the species, right? So, I mean, you know, going back to, you know, again, the very first incident in the book is Ransom trying to save a, again, possibly mentally handicapped guy from a scientist. That tension's, I think, there for a reason. And again, ruthlessness and just the, you know, the cold workings of biology and, you know, geological ages of time, as opposed to, again, the what we would call human, what in this book is, you know, refreshed for us as nowness. Yeah,
I'm tempted to go contemporary and talk about certain people's responses to the coronavirus.
Yeah. Right?
Sometimes you just gotta let it sweep through your nation, and if the old and the sick and the weak die off in the process, that is sad. Yeah. But, you know, what can you do?
Hashtag sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that is something that, again, Darwin himself was too polite to reach any of those conclusions, but of course all of his disciples like Huxley and Spencer were very eager to uncover and then again applying these things, and we've never, you know, again, World War II starts the year after this book is released, so eugenics gets a bad rap from the Nazis, but a lot of the underlying assumptions are still there. And, you know, you look at the proliferation of, like, euthanasia schemes in Europe now. I mean, all of that is, again, this weird sentimentality about the species that is willing to sacrifice particular individuals, right? And again, that's, you know, that's the difference between Ransom and Weston. And I think it's, stop me if I'm blathering too much, I think it's also interesting, again, toward the end, Oyarsa's own judgment is that, yeah, Divine is really bent, but he would actually do less damage in the long run because his greed and his lusts, I mean, it's darkly hinted he might actually be sexually interested in some of these creatures. His appetites are strictly physical, right? It's gut stuff where he's you know, so his ambition kind of ends with his own appetites, where Weston wants to sacrifice the universe to achieve some kind of ideological purpose.
Right. Divine would not kill them off, would feed them well and clothe them because, you know, happy workers are productive workers, and you get more labor out of the mines if your workers are well cared for and so on. Weston wouldn't care about any of that.
Yeah. Yeah, Weston is the guy who's, you know, shooting entire herds of buffalo so that civilized man can take over the West.
Right. we're over an hour now. Anything else you guys? I mean, there is more we could talk about, but we have two more of these books to get through, and I think it probably is good to end with Weston, because Weston undergoes a radical change, you know, spoiler alert, between this and Paralandra. So that might be a good place to stop. But anything else you guys wanted to point out, bring up out of the Silent Planet?
Yeah, just I'll go ahead. Something we talked about in the sort of pre-show conversation is George Orwell's later essay, Politics in the English Language, I think it's just an eerie prefiguring in Weston's last speech. Weston stands before Oyarsa, the angel of Mars, and has to give an account for himself, but is unable to express his ideas in the language of Malakandra. And so Ransom serves as his interpreter. But what Ransom finds is that the ways that Weston speaks, you know, talking about humanity in the abstract and, you know, the good of progress and many of his kind of modernist buzzwords simply are untranslatable into Malakandran, or when you translate them, sound like nonsense. And so, you know, we could not to get down, you know, thick into the weeds, but it's something very much like what George Orwell later explores in that essay, the idea that modernism has these God terms. We use that language before. It has these terms for which there is an almost religious reverence, that these are the things that are good. These are the things that must be preserved. Even though they are things that are so ill-defined, or when defined, are so facile, that you wonder, how is it that progress, things changing to change, or modernism, the thing that is now, and that is why it is good, is because it is now. You know. Anyway, it's a fascinating speech. So, you know, listeners, next time you pick up this novel, linger a bit over that last scene, and you know, consider what might it look like to take the God terms of our current conversations in our world. How would you explain that to a child or to a Martian? And if you find yourself speaking nonsense, maybe that's a clue.
Yeah. Yeah, his general skepticism toward various kinds of modernist snobbery is one of my favorite things about Lewis. And it also is also one of my favorite things about this book, although I also enjoy the adventure aspect of it as well.
All right, well, anything else? Otherwise, I was going to ask for some reading recommendations. If people like this book, what else should they read other than the rest of the books in the trilogy? But first, anything else on Out of the Silent Planet?
I don't think I have anything that can't wait till Paralandra. He does develop some running themes through all three of them. So, I mean, there's even a few things I could say that would maybe even be better suited to that hideous strength.
Right. Did I catch this right, David? You have not read That Hideous Strength?
I have read portions of it. I have never read the whole thing in one sustained sitting. I'm actually really looking forward to having a reason to make myself do it.
Make yourself do it might be a good way to put it, but we'll save that. In a series of books that are very okay, I think it's the least okay of them. But
it's the weird one.
We'll hold off on that.
We can talk about why,
it is
probably.
That. Reading recommendations then for people who have read this book and liked it and want to read more. What anything particular you guys would recommend?
I just lost my connection to Google Docs. I did have a few things written down. Rereading this older and hopefully at least a smidgen wiser, but also having read a lot more Lewis in the meantime, it reminded me of a number of his essays. So if you want to pick up some of what he's laying down here, I mentioned The Necessity of Chivalry, which is maybe tangentially related, but I think it does stem from some of the things that are animating certainly Ransom, and does touch as well on some of those kind of modernist assumptions about progress away from, you know, violence and war and stuff like that. That is a really, really fantastic essay. I've been contemplating a lot for about a year now. Another one is The Funeral of a Great Myth, where he tackles kind of popular conceptions of continuous evolution and upward progress, and a lot of, again, those kind of generalized progressive attitudes that are largely embodied by Weston in the book, but Devine has some, and even Ransom, right, is guilty of some of that kind of thinking as well. I read the rest of the trilogy, and this is by complete coincidence, but I've been reading a book by Christopher Dawson, who was a contemporary of Lewis's, and apparently they met a couple of times, but it's called Religion and Progress, and it's drier. I mean, it is academic, and it is slightly dated because he's critiquing a lot of like circa 1928 anthropology and sociology, and of course there's a lot of water under the bridge since then, but he is academically and from a religious standpoint critiquing a lot of the same kinds of assumptions about primitivism and, you know, leaving religion behind and underlying Darwinian assumptions about how societies develop and function and things like that. Some of which, accidentally reading these at the same time, I was struck by some of the similarities. So I'm would not be surprised if Lewis had at some point read that book.
I'd point people towards again. You should read the other two books in the trilogy. Lewis's essays are. Any of Lewis's nonfiction, or much of Lewis's nonfiction, I would say, is also worth reading. There is a fragment of a work that he started in this series called The Dark Tower. You can just find it in a little book of Lewis short stories called The Dark Tower and Other Stories. It's kind of an interesting read, and it's kind of the book I wish we had, at least based on the first few pages of it that we've got. Beyond that, I would say, we mentioned this earlier in the episode, Edgar Rice Burroughs' Martian Tales series are fantastic. I say that, the wife would insist I put in the footnote here, they are fantastic if you have, like, the attitude of an eighth grade boy. Like, it's very, this guy shows up on Mars and he punches people and they fly across the room and all of the, you know, women throw themselves at his feet. And I mean, it is that kind of story, but you know, what else do you want in a story? Right. So the Burroughs novels I think are just fantastic. And well worth reading. I think Lewis is interesting to read. I mean, there are any number of science fiction books after Lewis that are kind of interesting to set kind of side by side with what he's doing in this. This is, I think, of the trilogy, the one that's the most science fiction-y. So in Paralandra and in That Hideous Strength, we're, well, depending on what we do with some of what goes on in that Hideous Strength, we're basically just leaving the science completely behind. So this is the book to use as a gateway into things like Dune, and Starship Troopers and the various other classics of sci-fi. Paralandra, that Hideous Strength, don't fit in quite as well. They don't line up as well with the other genres. So I'd say Burroughs, and then use this to jump into more science, more sort of classic science fiction. David, do you have anything?
I'm just gonna, throw in my vote for Edgar Rice Burroughs' Barsoom books. They're super fun. I wonder too whether this constant suspicion through Out of the Silent Planet that the Oyarsa, who's in charge of the planet, is some kind of religious con job or Wizard of Oz kind of situation, is very much like the twist in the Barsoom books revealed in the second book, The Gods of Mars. I wonder the extent to which Lewis was sort of expecting to have readers who had been shaped by those novels. I've already mentioned Wells' First Men in the Moon. Understanding this novel, First Men in the Moon really does help that. But Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles, much later on, but especially the earliest stories, have some really interesting presentations of a non-human, a non-human intelligent society and the encounters of humanity with that society. A classic, actually, one before Lewis's writing, in 1934, in a science fiction story magazine called Wonder Stories, there was a short story called A Martian Odyssey, in which human astronauts take a trip to Mars, and one of them finds himself stranded, alone, and ends up with an alien companion who he has to figure out how to communicate with, and who becomes sort of his guide to the strangeness of life on Mars. Not a lot of sort of overarching plot similarities to what's going on in Out of the Silent Planet, but there is throughout this story, again, an emphasis on what might it be like to learn to communicate with a mind that works very differently from a human mind. Stanley Weinbaum's Martian Odyssey is a landmark in sort of that pulp era of science fiction for moving beyond aliens as monsters or aliens as green women who can fall in love with you.
I forgot to mention Jules Verne's Earth to the Moon. If you want a counterpoint to Ransom, Weston, and Divine, the Civil War veterans who build themselves a giant cannon and shoot it at the moon because there's no one left to fight on Earth, are just kind of a delightful study in contrasts.
Well, John
Verne is fantastic.
Well, John Carter is a Confederate veteran, isn't he?
He is a gentleman from Virginia, yeah. Right? But not a slave owner, if I remember right. That's benefits of I think Burroughs was he certainly lived in Montana when he was writing those. I think he was from there, so kind of just didn't really care about the Civil War.
Useful trappings, though.
Yeah.
I think I remember he was from in or around Illinois originally. Something like that.
I don't remember.
Anyway, his family fought on the northern side. I taught Princess of Mars a couple times, and my students were shocked to find out that Burroughs himself was not Southern or particularly sympathetic towards the South. And I was like, he's a fiction writer. He can write characters that aren't like him, and they're like, what? Anyway.
Don't say that online now.
Yeah. Well, and this isn't a Burroughs episode, but I'm sure he was thinking of the Virginian, right? In his writing of John Carter,
the ex-Confederate is the wandering ex-Confederate is like a big trope at this time.
Right, especially in Western fiction, right. Because where are they going to wander to?
Yeah.
Right. Certainly not the North. we should leave things there. We're starting to get into Burroughs and Western literature, which to the best of my knowledge, C.S. Lewis never wrote a Western, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
that would have been interesting for sure. Well, with that, we should leave things for now. The City of Man is a part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. I went a-walkin' that ribbon of highway.